Thanks, Liam, and good morning, everyone. So we know a lot of you are with Schools of Public Health. Do we have any nurses in the room? Thought we might have some of those. Do we have any communication researchers in the room? Good, good. Then you can call me out if I get anything wrong here. I'm excited to be here from the University of Kentucky to spend a little bit of time talking with you today about some communication science-based work we've been doing to help meet some of those mismatches that Marty talked about a little bit earlier, to help us identify where there are mismatches and what the community needs to know and what they do know and how we can help address those. First, I have to say I have no relationships to disclose. But I do want to acknowledge that the work that I'm going to be talking about here, various aspects of it have been funded by NIHS, EPA, and the U.S. Department of Energy. Really, what I want to talk about are three big issues while we're standing here today. The first is, why does context matter for environmental health literacy? Liam talked a little bit about health literacy. Marty talked a little bit about health literacy. But to my mind, what makes environmental health literacy so different is that it is so context-specific. Treatment regimens addressed in health literacy are the same in many instances, but contaminants, exposure pathways, all of those kinds of things are context-based. So why is it context-based? How can participatory risk communication really privilege context? And how can participatory strategies really elucidate context to help us identify those mismatches Marty was talking about, those environmental health literacy gaps, and preferences for helping to meet those information needs? So why does context matter for environmental health literacy? Earlier, Liam mentioned the SOFI definition of environmental health literacy, which you see here. And there are a few words in there that are clues to why context is important. Skills and competencies, seeking out, comprehending, evaluating, and using information. Choices, reducing risks, improving quality of life, protecting the environment. All of these are components that can have real context-based variation. So the available information that you have may be related to where you are. The choices that are before you are definitely related to where you are, and the risks that you're exposed to are often place-based, whether it be the contaminant. We're looking here at a map of Kentucky. Obviously, over here in eastern Kentucky, we have the coal fields. Those are one set of environmental exposures, one set of contaminants that you're dealing with. Up in here, we have a Superfund National Priority List site that has a lot of medical waste. Over here, we have a recently closed down uranium enrichment plant, which brings with it problems related to technetium, trichloroethylene, any number of contaminants, other chlorinated organics. So we have a diversity just in one state, a wide diversity of contaminants. We have each of those contaminants has its own exposure pathways of concerns. And we have varying socioeconomic and demographic factors. So you all know about Appalachian disparities, and that's what we've got over in the coal fields. We have some communities where, 50% of the population hasn't graduated high school. That creates its own special set of issues. We have urban communities in the Louisville area. See this dark red, meaning there are lots of Superfund sites and other contaminations. We have new immigrants in those communities. We have lower socioeconomic status African-American communities. We have a lot of issues in those areas that inform what kinds of information are appropriate, what kinds of choices are available to these folks, and what the risks are. In addition, EHL is context-based because it requires that we use our sense-making processes to understand these complex environmental issues and their impacts on our health. Sense-making is a collective process, meaning that when we leave this room, you might talk to the person sitting next to you about Liam's presentation and say, well, what I got out of that was this. And the person standing next to you say, well, yeah, that's what I got too. Especially if that person, if you're both, say, public health professors, you may walk out of here with very similar perspectives. But if a nurse walks out with a long-term academic and has that conversation, the nurse may have taken something different away from that. So the way we make sense is we listen to each other, we hear what we have to say, and we come to a better understanding of the situation or what we have just experienced. This is very important for environmental health literacy because a lot of these are very hot topics, particularly in the communities where these issues are occurring. And we have constraints on our ability to make sense of situations. Our sense-making is retrospective, meaning we make sense of what's happening right now based on what happened to us before. So if I've experienced with, say, a potentially responsible party in a Superfund site, the person who or the organization that is responsible for the contamination, and they haven't been forthcoming with information in the past, or they have provided information that was misleading in the past, and then I am expected to now believe something they give me about environmental health, well, I'm going to base whether I think that's true or not on my past experience. And if I'm talking only with like-minded people, we're going to have like-minded beliefs, and we're going to just reinforce each other. That echo chamber effect that I know you've heard about, where you only talk to people with the same perspective, well, that reduces your capacity to make sense of the situation. Then if you're known and have publicly made many statements about your beliefs about an environmental health threat, then you are committed to that. And we all know how hard it is to admit to maybe I was a little bit wrong about something, and that's on people on both sides of the aisle. I think we see that play out in our political process every day. I've taken this stand, and this is what I'm going to have to stick to because I've said that this is the way it is. So by committing very publicly, we kind of back ourselves into a little bit of a sense-making corner. And then again, those expectations, whether you believe people is based on what you've done in the past with that person. So those are all potential constraints on our sense-making. So how can participatory communication strategies help us identify environmental health literacy gaps and preferences in these really complex contextual situations? We've been using community-based participatory communication, which is a form of praxis. Praxis is something that is both a theory and a method that engages stakeholders through interviews, focus groups, and projective techniques. Now, what do I mean by projective techniques? I mean something that was designed for a lower literacy community. It can be an image, it can be an audio file, it can be a GIS map, it can be a storytelling exercise, some sort of technique to get a discussion going around an issue that does not require a high level of expertise in the issue. So we use those projective techniques to encourage these discussions so that we can find needs that and fill them so that we can support empowered decision-making in environmental health challenged communities. So specifically, community-based participatory communication, or CBPC, assists with identifying stakeholder groups and information needs, recognizing where the values and information preferences of different stakeholder groups, say people who work at a plant that is perhaps the polluter versus people in the local Sierra Club chapter. Where are their values similar enough that we can have a conversation as a whole, and where do we need to tailor things a little more specifically? And then we can develop targeted and stakeholder-appropriate materials to help us fill the specific needs of the specific stakeholder groups. So I just want to talk to you quickly about a couple of places where we have used these methods and how that has worked out. So CBPC at Superfund sites. I mentioned earlier the uranium enrichment plant in western Kentucky that has recently stopped operations. We've been working there for a very long time. They have one of the largest, you mentioned TCE, they have one of the largest trichloroethylene plumes in the nation. Right here, this is the Ohio River. And they've known for about 10 years that the plant was closing, but they hadn't made any decisions as a community what to do with this highly contaminated site. So we went in to help make sure they had the information they needed to determine what were appropriate uses for that site, what were inappropriate uses for that site going forward. And the way we started was with semi-structured interviews around the community. We did about 60 of those to help us identify the different stakeholder groups, different groups of people who shared particular beliefs, shared particular needs, so that we could engage them distinctly, identifying those divergent and convergent pieces before bringing them together. Once we identified those stakeholder groups, we developed future use visualizations. Here you can see a couple of them. They're a little faded on here, I'm sorry. But this was these were 12 visualizations to show what that location would look like if different decisions were made about the future. So this one indicates it's being used, I think, for light warehousing. This one, on the other hand, you can see there's a CERCLA cell, a waste disposal unit left on the site. And these were three visualizations that we were able to walk through with each of the focus groups and ask people to tell us Is this appropriate? Is this inappropriate? What do you need to know to make a decision about this particular use? We did that first through focus groups, and then after we had a sense of the convergences and divergences, we were able to bring people together in community meetings, and we created an online information portal. The results of that are available online if you want to know what the community thought was useful and what it wasn't, but they're sort of outside the context of this. Just wanted to let you know what we did in those communities. What we found were a lot of stakeholder groups who had very different perspectives. There's a wildlife management facility next to the plant, so there were a whole lot of people who hunt and fish who had very particular perspectives about what to do. There were obviously local environmental health advocates. There were teachers and educators. Because it was a federal facility, there was a site advisory board. Members of the religious community had some very distinct thoughts there. And obviously the media and the people who live within a couple miles of the site all had their own perspectives. And what we found were there were a lot of information needs. Some of them spanned across. Some of them spanned most of the stakeholder groups. Some of them were specific to one or two stakeholder groups. But some of the questions we had were things like, what chemicals are out there? You know, what do these chemicals do to health? And that was a pretty common one across all of the stakeholder groups. Even physicians wanted to know, what do those chemicals do to health? Because I hear stories, and I know I see a lot of cancer patients, but I'm hearing there's not a cancer cluster. So there, groups you would think maybe were not that interested or already had that information needed more. How much groundwater contamination is there? How are they monitoring waste? An interesting thing we always bump up against is, who are they? They are monitoring. They're supposed to be, but who is that? Is that the plant? Is that EPA? Is that the state? So that's an interesting question that comes up a lot in these discussions. Could an earthquake in a seismically active place disturb that waste? What keeps contamination from moving further south? And it has to do with Kentucky's karst topography. It's all very complicated, and I'll give you the number of a hydrologist if you want one. Is a wind farm an option for the site? And then how does the site affect my cancer risk? So there were a lot of questions that came up. But I also wanted to point out really quickly, and I know I'm running low on time, but we've also used this to look at post-crisis planning. You know, we all know about preparedness planning, and we're always talking about, okay, let's get ready for the crisis, and how do we set up to address the crisis? But we don't think a lot about what happens after the crisis. So we conducted a study funded by EPA to look at how to work with the community after a crisis has ended. When the scenario we were given was an intentional water contamination. So we were asked to figure out, once clearance has happened, once the site is clean, once the water is returned to pre-contamination levels, how do you communicate that to the public in a meaningful way? So we started with proxy case studies of crisis communication best practices. There are a whole lot of best practices in risk and crisis communication. And we looked at things like the TVA ash spill and the Minot train derailment and the Tar Creek Superfund site to help us think about which of these practices are being used, which aren't, and which seem to be really important. And then we began talking to technical experts, regulators, hydrologists, and others, water utility district folks, about what a response would look like, what the cleanup would look like, and how we would know when it was time to go. We then impaneled an advisory group. We did the same kind of stakeholder segmentation we had done in Paducah, and we developed a decision tree using these best practices in risk and crisis communication, segmenting out a few, yes, we're going to have a few best practices followed here, but not these, different ones over here, but not those. And we created radio news triggers. In this case, the news triggers were audio instead of looking at the visuals that I showed you earlier. So we had, I believe, I'll show you in just a minute, I think it was 8 or 10 radio news segments for people to listen to. We had stakeholder-specific groups. We broke them off. Each listened to a different set of news stories, came back together and talked about what they heard. And in that way, we identified what were some of the knowledge gaps. And we did that through focus groups. Here are your, this shows you how we broke that down. And I know it's kind of hard to see back there, but you can see, for example, I'm going to play vignette 3.2, which did not acknowledge uncertainty, which is a best practice, did not show compassion, did not have an efficacy message, but did acknowledge culture, didn't have an existing network or plan, didn't have a spokesperson available. I was hoping to play two of these. I'm only going to have time for one, but.
This is Action News at 6. Today's top story, the Do Not Use Water Order that's been in place since last week's water contamination crisis has been lifted today. For more on this breaking news, we go to Jim Greer, live.
to believe that 9 days have passed since suspect Jeremy Osborne intentionally introduced deadly spores into the water supply that serves the southeastern quarter of the city. Since that day, more than 12,000 residential customers, dozens of businesses, two elementary schools, and the community hospital were severely impacted by the Do Not Use order designed to help reduce the number of contamination-related illnesses. But after more than a week of cleanup and testing, City Hall and the Water Utility District issued a joint statement this afternoon saying that finally, our drinking water is back to national safety standards, and residents and businesses can now use their taps again. In the joint statement, Mayor Sandra Foster and Water Utility District Director Walter Jackson thanked emergency responders and others who have worked on this issue for the last 9 days. The statement also thanked the local media, including LaVaughn's newspaper, for helping the city's diverse community respond quickly to the situation as it developed. According to the joint statement, the Water Utility District is confident that the water supply has returned to its pre-contamination state. The statement directed customers who have any questions or concerns to visit the Water Utility District multilingual website, WUD.com, or call the helpline at 555-5555. The Water Utility District has English, Spanish, and French-speaking operators available to provide information and connect customers to local community groups if they need more personalized assistance. That number again is 555-5555. This is Jim Greer reporting live from City Hall.
So you can hear there that that addressed some of the best practices, but left off several others. And one of the big questions we were asking was, if there are best practices missing, who notices? What really matters in that message? And we found out a lot of things, but we also found out about a lot of knowledge gaps. So very quickly, the stakeholder groups we have were some of the usual suspects, because we were really looking in this case at gatekeepers. Who is going to have an opinion that is going to matter to community members in saying, yes, the water can be used again? So we've worked with promotoras and community health workers. We looked at college students because of their heavy online presence. We looked at healthcare providers. So we talked to a number of folks and new immigrants. And some of the questions that came up across these groups, again, some of them were very focused on specific stakeholder groups and some of them spread across. So what are the national drinking water standards? Obviously, the regulatory community didn't need to know that, but many of the other groups did. How is the water tested? And again, by whom? Who are they? If the water isn't safe for at-risk populations, then why is it safe for me? What symptoms should I look for? This one came up among homemakers. How do I clean my sink after I flush my pipes? In some of the messages, they say, run your water for 5 minutes. Well, if I run my water in my sink for 5 minutes, isn't my sink contaminated, and what do I do about that? Or my water heater. And then why should I, this one was specific to new immigrants, why should I believe that clear-looking water is dirty? We had a set of new immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa who were used to seeing very dirty water coming out of the taps, and they said, well, if it looks clean, then I'm going to think it's clean, and I'm probably not going to have stopped using it in the first place. So we found out some very interesting things doing that. In conclusion, and I'd love to talk with any of you after this at length about some of our findings, but in conclusion, environmental health literacy is context-based, and it does rely on sense-making processes. So varied stakeholder groups have different needs in terms of the information they need, in terms of what experiences they have to inform that sense-making process, and what their preferred information sources and channels are. And community-based participatory communication strategies foreground that context. We privilege it. It can help us identify stakeholder-specific needs and preferences to help us develop more appropriate, targeted environmental health literacy materials and programming. And with that, I just want to acknowledge my colleagues at the University of Kentucky and across Kentucky, and I will hand off.